Welcome to Shadows of Mystery, your gateway to the world of unanswered mysteries. This gripping podcast series dives into chilling cold cases and puzzling stories that continue to defy explanation. Join us in each episode as we explore the details, theories, and shocking twists behind these enigmatic events. Whether you're a true crime enthusiast or captivated by the unknown, Shadows of Mystery delivers thought-provoking narratives that will leave you questioning the world. The Axemen of New Orleans, a menace to Italian immigrants. In the summer of 1918, fear gripped New Orleans. A mysterious serial killer, later dubbed the Axemen of New Orleans, was terrorizing the city. Under the cover of darkness, he broke into Italian-owned grocery stores, brutally attacking the grocers and their families. Some victims survived with injuries, but four were left dead. His methods were chillingly violent. Joseph Maggio, for instance, was bludgeoned with his own axe and had his throat slashed with a razor. His wife, Catherine, suffered a similar fate, her throat cut so deeply she asphyxiated on her own blood. Although a few attacks on non-Italians were initially attributed to the Axemen, these were later ruled out. Still, the city was on edge. The Italian immigrant community in particular was paralyzed with fear. Men stayed awake through the night to protect their loved ones. Superintendent of Police Frank Mooney described the killer as a murderous degenerate who gloats over blood. The Axemen's reign of terror stretched from 1917 to March 1919, with his trail of violence eventually crossing the Mississippi River into the neighboring town of Gretna. On March 9, 1919, he attacked the Cortomiglia family, gravely injuring Charlie and his wife Rosie, and tragically killing their 2-year-old daughter. Mooney believed this was yet another attack by the Axemen, but Gretna officials had a different theory. Police Chief Peter Lesson and Sheriff Luis Marrero accused the Cortomiglia's neighbors, E. Orlando Giordano, an elderly grocer, and his 17-year-old son, Frank. The two families had recently clashed over a business dispute, and the authorities latched onto this as a motive. The problem? There was no evidence linking the Giordanos to the crime. Yet, undeterred by this lack of proof, authorities relentlessly pressured the injured Cortomiglias as they lay in Charity Hospital. Over and over they asked Rosie, "Who attacked you? Was it the Giordanos? Frank did it, didn't he?" According to her doctor, Rosie initially insisted she didn't know who her attackers were. But after her release from the hospital, Marrero arrested her as a material witness, jailing her until she signed an affidavit accusing the Giordanos. At trial, the only evidence against E. Orlando and Frank Giordano was Rosie's coerced testimony, which her own doctor doubted. Nevertheless, the jury swiftly convicted both men. E. Orlando, 69 years old, was sentenced to life in prison, while Frank was condemned to death. Then, 9 months later, an extraordinary turn of events unfolded. Rosie walked into the newsroom of the Times-Picayune and recanted her testimony. She claimed that St. Joseph had appeared to her in a dream, urging her to confess the truth. In a new affidavit, Rosie admitted she hadn't seen her attackers and had only implicated the Giordanos under duress from authorities. Despite Rosie's retraction, prosecutors stubbornly resisted dropping the case and even threatened her with perjury charges to force her to revert to her original story. Finally, in December 1920, after nearly 2 years of wrongful imprisonment, E. Orlando and Frank were freed. But why were Gretna authorities so quick to accuse the Giordanos despite a glaring lack of evidence? Why did they ignore warnings from the New Orleans police chief who believed a serial killer was targeting Italian grocers? These unanswered questions remain, deepening the shadowy legacy of the Axemen. For decades, Italians had been a vital part of New Orleans' cultural fabric. An Italian business community had taken root in the city well before the Civil War, with early immigrants primarily hailing from northern Italy. By the late 19th century, however, the demand for cheap labor ushered in a wave of Sicilian immigration. Men like E. Orlando Giordano, whose surname had been Americanized from Guagliardo, made the arduous journey from Sicily to Louisiana in search of opportunity. Sicilian laborers quickly became indispensable to Louisiana's post-emancipation sugar planters, who praised them as a hard-working, money-saving race, content with few of life's comforts. By the 1880s and 1890s, Sicilians dominated Italian immigration to the region, accounting for over 80% of the Italians arriving in New Orleans. Many put down roots. By 1900, the city boasted the largest Italian community in the South. Roughly 20,000 Italians, including the children of immigrants, called New Orleans home, reshaping the cultural and economic landscape of the Crescent City. Most Italian immigrants labored on sugarcane and cotton plantations, enduring a grueling existence that, nevertheless, allowed them the opportunity to save money. With careful saving, an immigrant could often establish independence within a few years. For plantation owners, this presented a significant drawback to employing Italian workers. Many planters complained that Italians would quickly lay by a little money and leave the fields to open fruit stands or grocery stores in small towns. By 1900, Italian-owned businesses had proliferated across Louisiana. However, the entrepreneurial success of Sicilian immigrants did little to shield them from the racial prejudices of the American South. Italians, who never completely replaced black laborers on Louisiana plantations, often worked alongside African Americans in the fields. Unfamiliar with the rigid racial hierarchies of the South, Italians saw no shame in this shared labor. Yet to native white Southerners, this willingness to work alongside black laborers branded Italians as no better than African Americans, Chinese, or other groups they considered non-white. Dark-skinned Sicilians were frequently regarded as racially inferior, often dismissed as black dagos. Even African American workers reportedly distinguished between Italians and other whites, treating Sicilians with a mix of casual familiarity and occasional contempt, an informality they would never extend to other white laborers. The perception that Sicilians were no better than black laborers fueled increasing prejudice against Italian immigrants throughout the 1870s and 1880s. They became targets of suspicion and, at times, violent mobs. By 1929, a New Orleans judge reflected the widespread disdain for Sicilian immigrants, describing them as thoroughly undesirable, comprising the most vicious, ignorant, degraded, and filthy paupers with a significant criminal element. This sentiment encapsulated the hostility and racial bias Sicilians faced in the American South. In New Orleans, the French Quarter, the oldest and most storied section of the city, became home to a thriving Italian community by the early 20th century. What was once a cluster of crumbling Creole townhouses transformed into an Italian enclave. In the lower French Quarter near the Mississippi River, so many Sicilians settled that the area between Jackson Square and Esplanade Avenue, bordered by Decatur and Chartres streets, earned the nickname Little Palermo. For ambitious Sicilian immigrants, one common path of upward mobility began with laboring on plantations, progressed to truck farming and street peddling, and often culminated in owning a grocery store. By the early 1900s, Italians were dominating New Orleans' corner grocery trade. In 1880, just 7% of the city's grocery stores were Italian-owned. By 1900, that figure had risen to 19%, and by 1920, Italians owned half of all grocery stores in the city. Some Sicilian immigrants achieved remarkable success in New Orleans. Joseph Vaccaro, who started as a laborer on sugarcane plantations, built a fruit peddling business from a mule-drawn cart. From a humble stall at the French market, he launched a wholesale empire, amassing a fortune importing oranges and bananas. Similarly, Giuseppe Udo began his entrepreneurial journey selling olive oil and cheese from a horse-drawn cart before founding Progresso Food Products, a name that became synonymous with Italian-American cuisine. Yet, despite these success stories, Italian immigrants often faced prejudice and discrimination. Stereotypes, some rooted in truth, painted Sicilians as clannish and distrustful of authority. Many brought with them the tradition of the vendetta, a system of personal justice prevalent in Sicily well into the 20th century. In New Orleans, these vendettas sometimes resulted in violent disputes, particularly along Decatur Street, which earned the grim nickname Vendetta Alley, due to frequent shootings and knife fights. The tension between the Italian community and the rest of New Orleans reached a breaking point in 1890-1891 with the murder of Police Chief David Hennessy. On the night of October 15, 1890, Hennessy was ambushed by a barrage of shotgun fire as he returned home. Mortally wounded, he reportedly uttered, "The Dagos got me," referring to Sicilian immigrants. Hennessy had been embroiled in a bitter feud between two Sicilian factions, the Provenzanos and the Matrangas, fueling speculation that his murder was tied to their rivalry. The public quickly blamed the crime on organized Italian gangs that the press labeled the Mafia. Police arrested several Sicilians, dividing them into two groups for trial. When an initial round of acquittals enraged the public, a mob stormed the jail and brutally lynched 11 of the accused, including some who had been acquitted and others who had yet to stand trial. While Italian criminal groups were undoubtedly active in New Orleans, historians argue that these activities were often mischaracterized. Crime historian Humbert S. Nelly has noted that the criminal behavior of Sicilian immigrants could not accurately be attributed to the Mafia as popularly understood. Historian Robert M. Lombardo further clarified that the Mafia was not a secretive criminal organization, but rather a social system rooted in the specific conditions of Sicily and southern Italy. According to Lombardo, it was a form of behavior and a kind of power, not a formal organization. The legacy of these events showcases both the resilience of New Orleans' Italian community and the formidable challenges they faced in overcoming prejudice to establish their place in the city's cultural and economic fabric. During this time, a form of petty extortion known as black hand crime, less an organization and more a practice, emerged. Victims were threatened with violence if they refused to pay the demanded sums. This type of crime was widespread in southern Italian communities across the U.S. by the late 19th and early 20th centuries, including in New Orleans. It only began to fade as immigrant descendants became more assimilated and willing to report such crimes to the police. At the turn of the 20th century, New Orleanians often conflated vendettas, the Mafia, and black hand extortion, using terms like Mafia and black hand interchangeably to describe organized crime. Against this backdrop, it's not surprising that many locals suspected the attacks on Italian grocers were tied to a vendetta or black hand scheme. However, New Orleans detective John D'Antonio, a nationally recognized expert on the Mafia, dismissed these theories. He argued that a true black hand attack would leave no survivors, unlike the Axemen's assaults. D'Antonio sided with Police Superintendent Frank Mooney, who believed the attacks were the work of a fiend, a man with a Jekyll and Hyde personality akin to Jack the Ripper. Mooney described the perpetrator as someone overtaken by an uncontrollable impulse to kill, a concept we'd now recognize as characteristic of a serial killer. Despite these conclusions, when the Axeman attacked the Cortomiglia family, Gretna authorities were more inclined to attribute the violence to a vendetta between Italian businesses than to accept the idea of a bloodthirsty serial killer stalking their streets. Even some New Orleans police officers continued to entertain the vendetta theory. Gretna officials, familiar with old-world Sicilian traditions, were quick to manufacture evidence against their obvious suspects. While this abuse of power is inexcusable, their ignorance of the emerging concept of serial killers is more understandable. Given the cultural context, suspecting an Italian vendetta wasn't entirely far-fetched, as disputes among Italian immigrants at the time sometimes escalated to violence. A closer analysis of the Axeman attacks reveals that not all assaults attributed to him were actually his doing. However, it is clear that someone was targeting Italian grocers, both between 1917 and 1919, and in a similar string of attacks in 1910 and 1911. Survivors' accounts describe the Axeman as a white, working-class man in his 30s when the killings began. His use of a railroad shoe pin, a common burglary tool, and the ease with which he broke into groceries led police to conclude he was an experienced burglar. The Axeman disappeared from New Orleans after the Cortomiglia attack. While some attribute the August 1919 murder of Mike Pepitone to the Axeman, it more likely stemmed from a long-standing vendetta. Police records and newspaper accounts suggest the Axeman resurfaced elsewhere in Louisiana, killing Joseph Sparrow and his daughter in Alexandria in December 1920, Giovanni Orlando in DeRidder in January 1921, and Frank Scalisi in Lake Charles in April 1921. Each crime followed the same pattern, breaking into an Italian grocery at night and using the family's own axe to carry out the attack. After these killings, the Axemen vanished from history. The Italians of New Orleans, however, endured. Over time, they prospered, becoming a vital part of the city's fabric. Although the rise of supermarkets eventually led to the decline of corner groceries, the community adapted. Like so many immigrant groups before them, they joined mainstream American society while preserving their unique cultural identity. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this story, don't forget to subscribe for more fascinating historical insights. Your support means the world to us, and we're excited to share more captivating tales with you.